What is the philosophy of Darwinian evolution, and why is it the most dangerous and deadliest religion in the history of the world? We'll talk about that on this week's episode of the Faith by Reason podcast. Welcome to the podcast. The website behind it all, as always, is faithbyreason.net. There you will find the blog, you will find our social media, our archives, tons of information, and of course you will find this very podcast. So we are still on the series of what's the point? What's the point of existence? What is the meaning of life? And in the last few podcasts, we've been talking about how existence came into existence. The first two podcasts, we talked about creation. We talked about the physics behind creation. Then we talked about what the Bible says about creation. And then in the last podcast, because I'm such a generous, magnanimous person, I gave the opposing viewpoint, which is that of evolution, the idea that there was no creator behind the first cause, that the universe came into existence naturally, and everything that we see, hear, smell, see, and touch, all life came into existence by random chance and accident. And we saw in that podcast definitively that that idea of natural evolution is impossible, not improbable, not unlikely, impossible, scientifically impossible, impossible by astronomic magnitudes. It can't happen. So if you believe in evolution, you believe in it based on faith. And if you believe in it based on faith, anything you believe in based on faith is a religion. And that's what evolution is. It's a religion. And in this podcast, we're going to explore the philosophy, the religious philosophy of evolution. And we will see why it is, as I said earlier, dangerous and deadly. Well, before we get there, I want to address some of the comments that I got on the last podcast. I was expecting some colorful comments, and I got them. Most of them, again, unfortunately, through email, and I wish folks would stop emailing me and would actually put their comments into the comments section. It would be much more beneficial for everyone to see the comments. So please give me your comments on the website, on Facebook, on Twitter, but stop emailing me. And most of the comments aren't worth addressing. A lot of them are just name-calling from some of my atheist listeners, and it's pretty much what I expected. Atheists tend to reduce themselves to childish name-calling when things don't go their way, and that's okay. In fact, I appreciate it because the surest sign that the attacker is losing an argument is when they resort to ad hominem attacks, when they attack the person instead of the message. So when you resort to calling me names, that's just a tacit admission that I'm right and you're wrong. So thank you for that. But unfortunately, name-calling ceased to be an effective counter-debate measure to me in about fourth grade, so sorry, you're kind of out of luck there. I also got a few comments saying that my science was off or that my science was wrong, but none of the people who commented that way ever said exactly what was wrong with the science. They just said it was wrong, and that's not very helpful, so don't do that. If you're going to say I'm wrong, tell me how I'm wrong, and I can look into it and try to correct it if possible. One comment I did get that I want to address is someone took me to task for me saying that only low-level scientists believe in evolution and high-level scientists don't. And that person said that Neil deGrasse Tyson, he is a high-level scientist and he promotes evolution all the time. And I agree that Neil deGrasse Tyson does seem to be a pretty prominent scientist. He seems to be a high-level scientist, but he's also the current spokesman for scientism. He's the scientific establishment's talking head of the moment. He's everywhere. He's in social media. He's on regular media. Anytime anyone has a science issue in the news, you will see him pop up and talk about it. And while, again, I will say he's a high-level scientist, he's not exactly unbiased. Again, he's a spokesperson. His job is to toe the company line, and the company line for the scientific establishment is that evolution is true. So, of course, he's going to say that. And then the guy brought up Bill Nye, the science guy. He's the one who's always, these days, debating creationists, and he obviously believes in evolution. And Bill Nye, I guess his basic claim to fame is that his last name rhymes with Guy, so I suppose if he was a car mechanic, he'd be Bill Nye, the car fixing guy. And I used to like the guy when I was a kid and I watched his show. It was actually, you know, pretty helpful in science for kids. But now he, in his later years, he's devolved into an old, bitter, grizzled attack dog for evolution, against creation. And so I guess whenever the establishment wants to debate a creationist, they pull Bill Nye out of his coffin and they have him go up there. And he's basically the evolutionary version of the old man on his front porch yelling at you to get off his lawn. So I'm sorry, I don't take him seriously either. Anyway, that's enough of those the comments. Let's get into what we want to talk about today, which is the philosophy of Darwinism. And the best way to start this conversation is to let's look at Charles Darwin. So what do we know about old Chuck Darwin? Well, Charles Darwin was a naturalist and a geologist in the 1800s. And he took a famous voyage on the HMS Beagle. I don't know why they named a boat after a dog, but so be it. It was an around-the-world journey where he stopped in several places around the world, and he observed the wildlife there, and he took his notes in it so that he could, you know, make his observations, write his observations down and compile them later. And one of his stops was in the Galapagos Islands. And while he was on the Galapagos Islands, among the other species he noted there were finches, these birds called finches. And these finches, he noticed, on different islands had different characteristics, especially in their beaks. There are certain islands you had finches that had long, thin beaks. And those finches were able to very efficiently get bugs out of narrow places with those long, thin beaks. Then there were other islands where you had finches that had short, stout beaks. And those finches they primarily ate fruit. And they used their short, stout beaks to crack open coconuts and other types of fruit, and they were able to eat it pretty efficiently. And then on yet other islands, you had finches that had short, sharp beaks, and they were leaf eaters. And those short, sharp beaks helped them to better consume leaves. So this, these observations, among others, led Darwin to have an epiphany. He believed that all of these different types of finches, and there were 12 different varieties, they all had a common ancestor, a finch with just a regular old beak. But what would happen is that at some point in the past, this finch gave birth to a little bird that was different, that had a different size beak. It was a mutant, and it had a long beak. And it turned out that this long-beaked finch was really, really good at getting insects because it had the long beak. It was much better than the normal beaked finches. And it reproduced and had more kids, and those kids had the same characteristics of the long beak. It passed that characteristic along genetically. And suddenly there was a population of finches that were really, really great at getting the bugs because of their long beaks. And they displaced the normal beaked finches because they took all the food. So the normal beaked finches died out because they were less fit than the long-beaked finches. And the same thing happened on the island where a normal-beaked finch happened to have a kid that had the short, stout beak, and it was able to get the fruit better. And it reproduced and had more finches with the short, stout beaks, and they dominated, and the regular finches died off. And Darwin came up with his theory that the fittest of the species will always survive and thrive, but the less fit will die off, and that's how the species advanced. So what Darwin did when he got back home, he looked at all of his notes and he expanded his theory to not just involve finches, but to involve all of life. All of life evolved from a common ancestor, the bacteria that we talked about in the last podcast. And as it mutated, one of these mutations led to advantages in the species. And those species that had the advantage, they were more fit. And survival of the fittest means that they survived and they bred, while the ones who did not have that that fitness died off. And that's really the basis of Darwinian evolution. That species evolve. If the evolution is advantageous, they'll thrive and pass it on. If it's not advantageous, then they'll die off and they won't survive and thrive. So Darwin published his findings in his famous book called On the Origin of Species, and it became an instant spectacular hit during his time. All the scientists loved the idea because it gave them an explanation of how life could begin and evolve and thrive without any type of supernaturalism at all. It gave a reason for them to justify their naturalism. Now, they believed in naturalism before Darwin. They believed in atheistic, secular origin of the universe and life, but Darwin gave them an actual, seemingly viable theory to tie it all together. So Darwin was famous, and he still is to this day famous. And again, it was a big hit in the scientific circles, and it's influenced everything in science, especially the science of biology, and even social science all the way up to this day. But the question is it true? Is it real science? Is it empirical? And the answer, like with everything with evolution, is no, it's not. And I was actually going to spend some time going step by step and showing why his process of evolution is unscientific, but that would take away from what I really want to get into, which is the philosophy. So I'll just suffice it to say that it's not empirically true for a few reasons, and I'll give a few of those reasons right now. And one of them is, again, there's no evidence. That is the biggest challenge to Darwinism, is there is no evidence of any animal evolving from one species to another. Now, I want to quickly differentiate between micro and macro evolution. Microevolution, I don't even like calling it microevolution because it's not really evolution. It's actually variation within the species. What that really is that you'll have one species that will have different genetic characteristics. For example, dogs. Dogs are a single species. They're canines. And they all had a common ancestor, a wolf. But you also have these dogs expressed something as variable as a Doberman Pinscher versus a Chihuahua versus a Great Dane. These are very different looking dogs. They have different physical characteristics, but they're all the same species. They didn't evolve from one species to another. They're just variation within that one single species. That's not the evolution that bothers Christians or bothers people who don't believe in Darwinian evolution. The one that we have a problem with is called macroevolution. That says that one species changes into another. That's the idea that we went from a single cell bacteria to a fish to an amphibian to a reptile to birds to mammals to monkeys to man. That's macroevolution. That's where the problem is. No one has a problem with microevolution. No Christian or any other religious type person has a problem with the idea of there being a variation within species. That's scientific. We can see that. The problem is the idea that one species becomes another species, and there is no evidence of that at all. It's not empirical. There is not a single animal that you can see on Earth today that is in a transition state. Every animal we've ever seen, ever observed, is fully, completely functioning as that animal. It is not slowly growing an appendage to become another animal. You don't have some land animal that has like partially formed gills so because it's becoming a sea animal, or vice versa. We don't see that. So not only do we not see it in contemporary science, we also don't see it in the fossil record. And there should be, if Darwin is correct, and evolution takes millions of years, we should see tons and tons of fossils of animals with partially forming appendages that, or whatever, slowly transforming into another animal. But we don't see any. There is no animal in the fossil record. Scientists are still looking for it. They call it the missing link. You know why they call it the missing link? Because it's missing. They are looking for links between species, and they have never, ever found one. Once in a while, they come out with the fossil that they initially say, oh, this is a transition species, but then it turns out that that's either an incomplete fossil or it's just a fossil of a fully formed animal of a species that has died off. So there is no evidence, no empirical evidence of it. And Darwin himself said that if the fossil record did not jibe with what his theory said, then the theory should be thrown out. And it doesn't, but people have not thrown out his theory because it's way more convenient to the secularists to keep him going, to keep his theory going, than to admit that it's wrong, which it obviously is. Furthermore, we know that mutations, which are key to evolution, are never beneficial. Mutations are always harmful. They are always accidents, and they are always harmful. You see, whenever any cell replicates, there is a protein that runs along the strand of the DNA checking for errors. And so that mutations are very, very rare. The only time they happen is if that protein doesn't do its job well and there's an accident. A mutation is always an accident, and it's always a bad accident. It is never beneficial. And sometimes you will see animals that are mutated, but they're never beneficial. For example, last year I saw an article about a sheep that had a fifth leg. That's a mutation. It's not supposed to be that way. That's a mistake. But that five-legged sheep was not faster than other sheep. That fifth leg didn't give it any advantage. It was actually a hindrance. It was a useless appendage. And if that sheep was in the wild, it would have quickly died. The only reason it survived as long as it did was because it was under the care of a farmer who took care of it. Otherwise, that animal would have died. There is no evidence of a beneficial mutation. It never happens. They're always accidents, and they're always bad accidents. And generally, if that animal is able to reproduce, its offspring will not have that mutation because the DNA is an error-correcting code. It corrects its own errors. So mutations are not beneficial. And so macroevolution can't happen. It's as impossible as any other part of evolution. And I'm not going to spend any more time on the physical part of this because we saw in the last podcast, you can't even get to a to a protein by random chance, let alone a single-celled organism, let alone complex life, let alone fish to monkey to man. You can't get there. It's impossible. So we're going to get away from that, and we're going to talk about the philosophy of Darwinism. That's what's most important, or what's most important to us on this podcast. So what is the philosophy? Well, if you look at what Darwinian evolution really says, if you look at the idea that everything is happened naturally through random chance, then everything you see, all life you see, is nothing more than a random accident. That means we, human beings, we are nothing more than a result of a series of cosmic accidents. You are not special, according to Darwin. There is nothing special about you. You are not made in the image of God or any transcendent creator. You don't have a soul. You don't have a spirit. You are nothing but an animal. You are a highly evolved animal, but an animal nonetheless. Your life is not valuable. Your life is no more valuable than that of a cow or a chicken or a pig or a horse or a cockroach. Your life means nothing. If you're a Darwinian evolutionist, then the answer to the question of what's the point is there is no point. How can an accident have a point? It doesn't. You have no purpose other than to reproduce and just keep the species going. You have no higher purpose at all. And that is truly tragic. And that is one of the biggest tragedies of the Darwinian philosophy, is that human beings are not special. Our lives mean nothing. So according to Darwinian philosophy, the only, I guess, purpose, for lack of a better word, that we have as a species would be to keep the species evolving. So what we would want to do is make sure that the fittest of our species keep going and that the unfit of our species die off. That's really our only meta-level responsibility. But that leads to some big problems. And I think one of the biggest problems, I think you can probably see pretty easily that this leads to, is something called racism. So if there are members of the species that are more superior than others and others are inferior, and we human beings tend to categorize our physical differences, unfortunately, along racial lines, then that means that, according to Darwin, there are some races that are superior to others and others that are inferior. And that's what racism is all about. And this isn't just me speculating. Darwin himself, in his second book, which is not quite as famous as Origin of Species, but it's as impactful, if not more so, especially on our social world, is called The Descent of Man. And in The Descent of Man, Darwin makes no bones about the fact that he does not consider people who are savages to be worthy of continuing on in the human species. And who does he consider savages? Why? Anyone who's not European, especially since he's European. And stick a pin in that. We're going to get to that in a second. But he also thinks that any human being that has a weakness does not deserve to continue on. If you have a mental illness, if you are not very smart, if you are infirmed in any way, you should be gotten rid of. And he takes to task charitable people and insane asylums and welfare that helps out people who are not quite as fit, people who are mentally disabled, physically disabled, and because he says all you're doing is prolonging the inferior people in the species, and we shouldn't do that. We need to make sure that only the fit survive and reproduce. Darwin sounds like a pretty awesome guy, doesn't he? And of course, that naturally leads to racism, where people think that one race or one group of races are better than another group of races. And here's where I want to get back to the whole savages thing, where anyone who's not a European is a savage. Have you ever noticed there's something very interesting about racists? And that is that racists always think that they happen to belong to the superior race. Have you noticed that? Whenever someone says, well, there is racial superiority, they just happen to, by sheer luck and circumstance, belong to that superior race. If you're a white racist, then you think that white people are the superior race. If you're a black racist, you think that black people are the superior race. If you're an Asian racist, you think that Asians are the superior race. You just happen to have belonged to that superior race. Aren't you lucky? You never see it happen the other way around. You never see a white racist say, well, you know what? There's a superior race and it's those Asians. You never see that. It's always the race you happen to belong to. And aren't you just lucky for that great coincidence to have happened? And racism is so stupid. I mean, if you're a racist, you're someone who believes that you are superior because you happen to fall out of your mother's womb, not because you accomplished anything, but because people who look like you accomplished something. I mean, I've heard black racists say that, because darker skinned people are the ones who built the pyramids and invented mathematics and astronomy, that darker skinned people are the superior race. Well, wait, just because someone else invented something and you look like them, that doesn't transfer to you. I mean, the person who designed the first pyramid, he was brilliant. Maybe he or she was mentally superior. And whoever invented mathematics, if they be they dark skinned or not, I guess I could argue that they had a mental superiority, but how does that transfer to you? It doesn't. And I would hear white racists say that, white people, we invented all the modern conveniences of society, that Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. Yeah, Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. What does it have to do with you? You're a truck driver in Indiana. How does that transfer to you? I would dare say that a black kid who's an engineer at MIT has much more in common with Thomas Edison than a white guy driving a truck in the Midwest. Racism is stupid. But the biggest problem with racism is not the mentality behind it, but actually the physical acts that go along with it, such as oppression, denial of rights. This country, America, has a long and sad history of treating minorities horribly because of racism. And then when you extrapolate it onto a larger scale, you have things like ethnic cleansings. And I hate the term ethnic cleansing. It sounds like you get a bar of soap and you're washing down ethnic people. No, ethnic cleansings is mass murder of people who don't look like you, and that is just horrifying. And it's grown exponentially since the adoption of Darwinian philosophy, and you have areas like Chechnya and Darfur and Sudan and places in Africa and all over the world where people are being ethnically cleansed simply because of the way they were born, and that's just crazy. It's cruel, it's inhuman, but it's one of the fruits of Darwinism. But I can argue that social Darwinism is, in a way, even worse than the physical traits that people use to differentiate each other and pit one race or group against each other. Social Darwinism doesn't just say that the inferiority or superiority is based on physical stuff. It actually says that where you are in society makes you worthy or not worthy of life. Whether you're smart or dumb or rich or poor, that designates whether you're fit to survive, or even the philosophy you have. As an example, a few years ago, I was out at happy hour with some coworkers, and one of the coworkers, who was an atheist, he was starting to drink, and he started talking about religion. Isn't it funny how atheists always want to talk about religion? Very interesting. Anyway, I didn't bring it up. He brought it up. I was just wanting to enjoy my beer, but he wanted to talk about religion, and he said that, religion, that's the biggest problem in the world because religion is the reason behind all the wars and conflicts in the world. I'm like, oh my God, that's such a galactically stupid statement. Most wars are not fought over religion. Most wars are fought over conquest. One country or group of people is trying to conquer another group of people, and that's why wars are fought. So I gave him a little quiz. I said, World War I, 20 million people dead. What religion was it fought over? Oh, well, it wasn't fought over religion. Yeah, I know. Let's try another one. World War II, 50 million people killed. What religion was that fought over? Oh, yeah, well, World War II wasn't fought over religion. Yeah, I know. Good job. The communist revolutions in Russia and China, conservatively speaking, 80 million people slaughtered. And we know they weren't fought over religion. They were actually atheistic. Communism is atheistic. And they killed almost 100 million people. That's more than all so-called religious wars combined. So I told him I could actually make an argument that atheism is the cause of more destruction and mass murder in the world than religion. And, he didn't have anything else to say about that. He just went back to his drink. But the point is that communism is a philosophy. It's an atheistic philosophy. And because it's atheistic, they believe that it's perfectly okay to kill and slaughter anyone who does not toe the line and does not go along with the idea of the communist utopia. And that's exactly what happened under Stalin and Mao. They slaughtered millions of people. That's one of the fruits of social Darwinism. Another is the way the poor people are treated, because according to social Darwinism, poor people are inferior. If they weren't, they wouldn't be poor, now would they? And because of that, poor people get the short end of the stick. They live in areas that are the least desirable. People feel perfectly justified in building nuclear power plants and power lines and trash dumps near where poor people live. Why? Because who cares about them? They're poor. They're not fit. The fit people are the rich people. They get to live in the good areas and have the good stuff. I will say personally, I grew up quite poor. I remember going to the supermarket, going to the produce section and seeing the produce, which was in bad shape. It was wilted and there were flies around. And honestly, I thought that's just how vegetables were. When vegetables came to the supermarket, they just weren't in good shape. And, you know, later on, after I went to college, got my education and started working and gained some level of affluence, and I moved into a more affluent area, and I went to the same grocery store chain, and I noticed something very different. Again, same chain of grocery stores. I went to the produce section in the affluent area, and the produce was beautiful. It was shining, vibrant, healthy. Why? Again, it's the same store, but they treat the produce in the rich areas, the affluent areas, much better than they treat that in the poor area. Why? That's subconscious social Darwinism, treating the poor worse, oppressing them, denying them opportunities because they don't socially fit in. So why should they be healthy and continue to reproduce and just produce more of these inferior poor people in the world? Horrifying, but another fruit of Darwinism. And I'll give you another one, abortion. I'm not going to get into the politics of abortion. I'm not interested in that right now. But what I want to get into is the prominent abortion organization in this country, Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood was started by a woman named Margaret Sanger. Margaret Sanger was a virulent racist and a eugenist. She believed in racial superiority, and since she was white, guess which race she thought was superior? I'll let you think about that. But she believed that abortion was a way to eliminate inferior races. She called them human weeds. And I'm not making this up. You can Google Margaret Sanger and human weeds, and you will see all her quotes about what she felt about people who are not white, particularly black and brown people. And she saw Planned Parenthood as a way to eliminate these inferior races. That's why she put Planned Parenthood and planned to have Planned Parenthood clinics in poor and minority neighborhoods to get rid of them. And that's why I find it very interesting and very funny that the political party in this country that claims to be on the side of minorities virulently supports Planned Parenthood. In fact, one of our most recent former president, who is African-American, well, more or less, technically an African-American, is the descendant of African slaves. And this president was not. He's a son of a native Kenyan man and a Caucasian woman. So, but whatever, he's a minority. He's on record as saying, God bless Planned Parenthood, ignorantly unaware that if Margaret Sanger had her way, Planned Parenthood would have had him killed before he was ever came out of his mother's womb. Yet, God bless Planned Parenthood. Moronic. But again, that's the fruit of Darwinian philosophy. So for all you snide atheists out there who are always complaining about religion and saying all the horrible things that religion does, well, your religion, atheism, Darwinian philosophy, the fruit of your religion, the things that your religion condones is racism, oppression, mass murder, genocide, oppression of poor people, denial of rights. That's the fruit of your religion. That's what you're all about. That's what your religion condones, supports, and advocates in order that the fit survive. That's your religion. So sleep on that. But you know, enough about evolution and Darwinism. I'm done with it. I don't like talking about it. It's so stupid. And hopefully I never have to talk about it again on this podcast. I probably will, but hopefully not. I want to move on to what the main crux of this series, which is what's the point? And fortunately for us, Darwinian evolution and that philosophy is absolutely wrong. But I have to get into one more thing. I'm sorry. One more thing, which is the question I said I posed in the last podcast, which is, if this philosophy is so bankrupt, and it is, and if evolution is unscientific, which it is, why is it the primary philosophy, the primary worldview of our culture? Why? Well, there are two main reasons. One main reason is what we talked about at the end of the last podcast, which is that the secularists know that it's wrong, they know that it's unscientific, they know that it's morally completely bankrupt, but the alternative to the evolutionary philosophy is to believe in the supernatural, to believe in God. And they don't want to, not for any logical, moral, or scientific reasons, but because they don't like the idea of a God, and therefore they choose to believe in what is scientifically impossible and what is absolutely morally bankrupt. The other reason, reason number two, is because of Christians. The reason that we Christians are losing this war on the culture is because we, by and large, are ignorant, lazy, and cowardly. We do not want to confront the evolutionists, and we have the high ground. Evolution is impossible. It's easy to disprove. Yeah, we don't want to do it. When someone confronts, when an atheist confronts a Christian about evolution versus creation, the average Christian these days in this age will say, "Oh well, you know, I don't want to get into that. I don't know about all that creation evolution stuff and what's true and what's not true. All I know is that I love Jesus and Jesus loves me, and that's all that matters. So I'm going to stick my fingers in my ear and say la 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 la, and just sing another hymn."
Meanwhile, you go off to college, or you send your kid off to college, and they get confronted by their atheistic professor or their secular peers, and they ask them questions about the faith that they can't answer, stuff we've gone over in the past couple of podcasts, and because they've been so poorly prepared by the church, they can't answer the question, and they just get completely annihilated, and they start to question their faith. The professor destroys them in front of the whole class, or their secular peers, you know, make fun of them because they believe that, you know, God created the world as opposed to all the years of evolution we've been trained in, and off they go, and they lose their faith. I mean, is there any wonder why the statistics clearly show that most kids who grow up in the church go off to college, and by the end of their 4 years or 4 years plus in college, they end up leaving the faith? Why? Because we haven't given them any answers. The only thing we've given them in the church is, "I love Jesus, and Jesus loves me. God said it, I believe it, and that settles it." And while I guess that's technically true, it's a horrible, horrible counterargument. God said it, I believe it, and that settles it. Really? Please, try, go up against an atheist with that with that argument, and you're going to get laughed off the stage. Or you know what, forget an atheist. What if you're confronted by a sincere person who really is questioning life and wants to know the meaning of life and is looking at Christianity? What are you going to tell them when they have some questions, when they say, you know, I'm looking for answers for my life. I'm looking for a purpose to believe in, and I want to look into Christianity, but you know, there's some things that I don't understand about it because I've heard of evolution all my life. So can you tell me how God created the universe? Can you tell me about how dinosaurs fit into it? Can you just give me some information about how this God you believe in matches up with reality? And if the only answer you can give them is, "Well, all I know is I love Jesus and Jesus loves me. God said it, I believe it, and that settles it," you're going to lose them. They're going to say, "Well, if these Christians can't even explain the simplest basics of their so-called faith, why should I follow them? I'll go someplace else." And you've lost that person, probably lost them forever. Why? Because you haven't been trained, and you haven't pursued the training, even though it's right there in front of you. And the funny thing is, I had something happen recently that just reinforced this. You know, when I do these podcasts, you know, I kind of do them off the cuff, but I have notes. I take notes about some things I want to make sure that I cover, and I write those notes, you know, weeks and months in advance. And when I was doing the podcast, a couple of podcasts ago, about the physics of creation, you know, I wrote those notes, a few months before the podcast. And in those notes, I made a note to myself to make sure that, you know, I speak as clearly as I can and try to use examples, because someone is going to gloss over what I talked about and just give the whole classic, you know, I don't know about all that, but God said it, I believe it, and that settles it. And sure enough, you can't make this up. In my Facebook post on that particular podcast, someone literally wrote down, in the notes for the podcast, I'm sorry, in the comments for the podcast, they wrote down, "Well, physics is one thing, but I rely on my faith." So basically saying, you know, "God said it, I believe it, and that settles it." And I'm thinking, all you have to do, you don't even have that excuse anymore. All you have to do is just click on the podcast and you would have all these answers. You wouldn't have to just rely on your faith. And don't get me wrong, we have our faith and we should rely on it. But if you have just faith without knowledge, and you add knowledge to that faith, wouldn't that make your faith even stronger? I mean, if you needed a liver transplant and you were believing God that you were going to get a transplant, that's great. But what if you believe God and you got a phone call from your doctor that same night saying, "Hey, you're number one on the list to get the next liver"? Wouldn't that knowledge combined with your faith make your faith even stronger? So I understand if you believe in creation purely based on faith, but if you believe it based on faith and you have knowledge, wouldn't that strengthen your faith? Wouldn't you want that? But this person didn't even do that. They could have just clicked on the button and got knowledge to go with their faith. In fact, it would have taken them less effort to click on the button to listen to the podcast than it did for them to write down that they were going to be intentionally ignorant and just rely on their faith. God said it, I believe it, and that settles it. I mean, is it any wonder why we're losing the culture war? Why we pretty much lost the culture war? If we don't even have the fortitude to just click on a button and learn about everything you need to know in order to defend your faith and defend biblical creation? Oh, I don't want to do all that. That's too much effort. That's too much thinking. All I know is that I love Jesus and Jesus loves me. God said it, I believe it, and that settles it.
Cowards. Disgusting cowards. You have the high ground. All you have to do is just let them listen to this podcast and the last one. We have the high ground. We have truth on our side. When someone says, oh, you're a magic man in the sky, spoke the universe into existence, all you have to do is say, absolutely. Because according to quantum physics, someone thinking about matter on the quantum level is the only way that matter can exist. So yes, a supreme being had to have thought about it and thought it up in order for it to exist on the quantum level. And if it exists on the quantum level, then it exists on the atomic level. And that means it's real, as far as what we see as real. That is the explanation. And that's the only explanation that makes sense. Life coming from nothing makes no sense. It's impossible. It's unprovable. But Christians won't do that because we're too afraid of being rejected. We're too afraid of being made fun of and called names, and we're too cowardly, and we're intentionally ignorant. The stuff I've just been presenting in the last two podcasts is not stuff that I discovered on my own. There are I am indebted to people who have done even more research than I have. It's easy to find this kind of information out there to defend yourself, but again, too lazy to look it up. So we're intentionally ignorant as Christians, and we're big cowards and will not confront and stand up. And so instead we compromise with stupid things like theistic evolution. And this is a compromise. It's actually the prevailing view of the Catholic Church of all places, but a lot of other Christians use it as well. And the theistic evolution says that, well, you know, God started life on earth, but then it evolved after that. That's a compromise to make us look less dumb in the eyes of evolutionists. We don't have to. Again, we have truth on our side. There's no need to compromise. Stand up. Stop being cowards. All right, so moving on. As I said, we're going to get back to the idea of what's the point. And again, since evolution is wrong, we don't have to worry about life being pointless. Life does have a point. Evolution is wrong. We do have purpose. We were not created by random chance. We did not come here by accident. We came here purposefully. We were purposefully created by an intelligent, loving creator. And that creator created us with and for a purpose. The question is why? Why did he make man? Why did God make man the way he did? And why do we exist as we do? Well, in the next podcast, we're going to get into that. We're going to look at what man is, why man is unique among all creation, why God made us the way he did, and we're going to also answer the question that has vexed believers and unbelievers for centuries. And that question is, if God is good and loving and all-powerful, why is there evil in the world? How can a good, loving, and all-powerful creator allow evil? We're going to answer that question in the next podcast. So, thank you again for listening. I appreciate it. Please leave me your comments, subscribe to the blog, subscribe to the podcast, and I will talk to you next week.